You're listening to the Whole Hog Sports Podcast. And now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
For years, whether it be Frank Broyles, Jeff Long, Hunter Yurecek, ADs at Arkansas have taken great pride in the fact that the athletics program is self-sustaining. That's not the case anymore. They're going to start getting money from the university. About $6 million is going to be the amount, plus it's really going to be about a $10.5 million swing because the university's going to forsake some money that has been transferred back to campus from the athletics department. So this is a big deal. This is really kind of a fundamental shift in the way they do business. And you had some comments about that this morning on the radio. Just share with people your thoughts on this.
Damn, if I knew you were listening, I wouldn't have commented on it. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing's changing. And I hate the phrase, but it's the only one. It is what it is. And I'm not happy about all the things. I think it's I don't have a problem with players getting compensated. I would have, you know, I think a lot of good, like when I was in school, my dad had leukemia. And we were from a lower income family. And, you know, I think about how I could have helped my mom and how I could have done things for my brothers to go to school and things like that with just a little bit of money. And so I don't think it's all bad. And I think the amount of money that is generated from the athletics and the school, players should be compensated. Now, but the problem is there's no rules. And when there's no rules, it's the wild, wild west. And it's not going to change until somebody, they legislate some kind of, you know, rules to this thing to where it can't keep spiraling, you know, out of control. Because it used to be an arms race with practice facilities, you know, how we travel. That used to be the arms race now. Now it's how much can you pay me? How much can you pay me? How much can you pay me? And then when you're a free agent every year, that never changes. And that's where the problem is to me, is that you got to get the portal somehow under control. I have no problem with a kid transferring one time, or if the coach gets fired, you know, to those, you know, you should be able to leave under those circumstances. But four schools in 5 years, some kids went to five schools in 5 years. I don't like that. It's not good for the sport. I don't think in the long run, if you have everybody up for bid every year, it's going to hurt the overall sport. But to get back to your initial question on the Board of Trustees, which is kind of the money thing, all this NIL stuff and the money is why we're at where we are right now. The thing that made me uncomfortable, and I just learned about it this morning, I think it's very, very important. It's the most important thing that the board, the chancellor, and the AD are in line and lockstep together. If they are not in line and they are not all in and they figure out, you know, everybody's not going to agree on everything, but they get in line and this is our plan. This is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to move forward. What I didn't like, what I read today, is three board members, it sounded like that was kind of put on them. They hadn't had time to, you know, they're going to vote on this thing, and they're like,
they were given the resolution yesterday morning.
Yeah, they were given the resolution yesterday morning. Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, we're going to do $11 million, and we're going to talk about it. We're going to vote on it tomorrow. And so I didn't like that. The chancellor felt like he was in the same boat. And and Hunter even said, you know, this is the first time I've seen the resolution. So I did not like that at all. I don't think that's not how you do it. Mm-hmm. You guys have been on boards. You guys have been business people. And I'm no genius on that, but that's not how you do it. You work together. Before all this comes out, you get in lockstep. You get together, this is what we're going to do, this is what we believe in, this is how we're going to do it, and you work out all the, you know, infighting or disagreements before you come out with it. So I did not like that. That made me, the fact that it felt like there's division, mm-hmm. it made me uncomfortable.
Well, and I think part of the hesitation for the leadership, too, is the principle of potentially charging your students to pay for your athletes. That's something that's going to have to be resolved. Yeah. Out of this resolution yesterday, they basically told the leadership of the university, hey, you go figure it out. Well, figure it out probably means either student fees or a hike in tuition.
Yeah, I can only think of one way universities earn money. I mean, is there another way? I mean, there's student fees and tuition is the main. I mean, it's not selling a barbecue sandwich, I can tell you that. That basically is saying that's where it's going to go. And again, I'm not in that room. I don't have the financials in front of me. And this is and that's why I kind of led with what I led about the NIL. These are trying tough times. I mean, I read yesterday that Rutgers is hemorrhaging money. They are, they are at a critical point of what are we going to do? And like, are we going to do this? Being the Big Ten and do all this. I mean, can we do this? And so you're getting to that point, and there's going to be more and more. You know, you got Texas paying $300 million a year for all this stuff. Tennessee, $300 million a year. And, how is that sustainable from a standpoint of, in the NBA and in the NFL and the Major League Baseball, you have an owner. And you go, this is going to cost you $300 million, and it's like, and that's your problem. You need to figure it out. And you got to figure it out with your money. Mm-hmm. I don't mind paying taxes, but I hate paying taxes because I see what they do when I pay taxes. Mm-hmm. And there's no accountability. Where's the accountability? Where's the, we need $15 million. All right, what do we need it for? Mm-hmm. I need 15. If that's how it's going to work, I'll take five.
I'll take the rest.
So, I mean, I worry about being on the same page. And then, accountability. What's the plan? Where's the money going for? I don't expect them to tell me, how much they paid for gas but the big stuff. What's the plan?
Let's talk about something a little bit more fun.
That's
this Razorback basketball team. You were courtside last Saturday night calling the game against LSU. You talked about you saw them, you watched them play against OU the other night. Joe, the thing that stands out to me are two things. Number one, those are the two last place teams in the SEC, which I think tells you about the depth of the conference.
Absolutely.
But then also, this was like last year, this team early in the season, they did not know how to win those close games. And that seems to me, and I know it's different players, but that seems to me the biggest difference from last season is that they're a lot better in close games and knowing how to finish them.
Well, it's so funny watching Cal coach last year and watching him coach this year, especially at practice. Because last year it was like, you're good. I believe in you. You can do it. I got to pull you across the finish line. We can do this. Trust me, and now it's like, if you can't do it, I'm going to get somebody else in there that can do it,
Yeah.
Because his expectations are higher. He's coaching. Last year he was trying to get his team to believe. This year he's kind of like, hey, y'all are good now, but you still got to show up and play. You ain't that good. And so there's a little more tough love, a lot more tough love. Last year there was, it was like, your firstborn, it was like your first month of marriage. Everything's, do it. It's great, man. Everything. And then all of a sudden the questions start coming. But anyway, you can see my wife's not here. So, that's the difference. And you're talking about, I don't think the SEC is the best conference this year. I think the Big Ten and the Big 12 are better, especially up top. I think they'll get more teams in, but you just alluded to it. The bottom of your LSUs, your South Carolinas, your Oklahomas, they are more than able on any given night, especially at home, to give you a beating. So I think it's a a harder, I don't think it's a better conference. I think it's a harder conference.
Porter Moser, the Oklahoma coach, he had comments the other night about how elite Arkansas is at getting downhill in the dribble drive. And you look at two games this year, South Carolina, I think they had 66 points in the paint. OU the other night, they had 56. I think that's the most they've ever had in an SEC game, those two games. You played in the post before. What makes it difficult to defend them when they're coming downhill at you?
Well, first of all, they can shoot. So when you can shoot, you got to go out. If you can't shoot, you just sit back. You just say, come, we'll wait for you right here. You know, we're here in the paint, and we'll wait till you come because you're not going to hurt me out there. So you get some of these guys out there that can really, really shoot it. You know, now you got to go out. When they ball fake, you may not jump, but you might lean. You know, you're going to react. And so, and then you have Acuff. I mean, you can't stay in front of him. And so now you have a guy that's getting into the lane, shooter, lob, and now you got problems. So what do? Do you double team Acuff? And that's where teams kind of take off. That's where all the great teams do. Offensively, you're always trying to get two guys to guard one or three. And back in my day, it was through the post. We're going to throw it into Barkley. We're going to throw it into Bird, Kareem. And you either send help or he's going to score 60. You know, Patrick Ewing, et cetera. Well, now it's still the same premise, but it's done with the pick and roll. They're trying to get downhill in the lane, shooter, corner, guy going for a lob, pick your poison. You better come stop Acuff. Well, you're going to leave him, or you're going to leave him, or I'm going to throw it to Ewing for a lob. And so I think that's what makes them so good, is that you have to get out there and honor their shooting ability, and then you can't – no, I mean, one-on-one, you can't stay in front of Acuff.
I thought a key to the game the other night, too, was the fact that, like, Malik Thomas, he quit just standing out on the perimeter and shooting threes. Cal or somebody on that coaching staff got through to him and said, they're not protecting the rim.
Right.
You've got 3 points there.
Well, and that's the other beauty about being able to get in the lane, because when you kick it out, you got a guy running to you. It's a lot harder to drive around a dude when he's down in a stance waiting for you. But if a guy's running at you and you can attack him off the dribble, you can get into lane. So you get the teams chasing the ball. They start chasing that ball, trying to catch up with the ball, and you got, you know, Brazil can drive it. Knox can drive it. Thomas can drive it. Acuff can drive it. Now you can't stay in front of them. And that was the beauty of the other – you know, I'm always so frustrated with analytics, because it's like, okay, I get it. We're going to shoot the three. We're going to score layups, shoot the three, or shoot free throws. That's what we're going to do. Okay, well, when you're 4-for-28, what's plan B? You know? And I get so frustrated with teams, and it's like, we're gonna keep shooting it. We're gonna. And I was really glad to see the other night that it was like, hey, you know, we're 2-for-17. Mm-hmm. We're going to the hole, mm-hmm. And you know, it worked to perfection.
Acuff, his pro potential, what is it?
It's good. I mean, you know, you always hope they get with the right team, with the right group of guys. You know, sometimes not being the top 5 or 6 player taken is a good thing, because you end up moving down a little bit, you're going to play with better players, mm-hmm. and probably with better coaches. So I think he's – I mean, the guy can – the guy's decision-making is – I mean, he's had 2 games this year, 13 assists and no turnovers, and 9 assists and no turnovers. And he's playing he's playing 36 minutes a game. Mm-hmm. And again, they're playing at a pace. They're not walking it up the floor. And, you know, we're going to run one. You know, we're going to run play number 4. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's going up and down the floor, having to make decisions at a high rate of speed, which is much harder to do, and he doesn't turn it over. So I look at that, and then, he can shoot. And when the shot clock's going down, you can throw it to him, and he can get his own shot. And that's huge in the NBA because – you know, I played with Michael Jordan on the Bulls, and the triangle offense was awesome. It was awesome. You know why? Because with 5 seconds on the shot clock and everything had broken down and nothing was working, we threw that damn ball to Michael and he made a basket. And then everybody walked around going, the triangle is awesome.
Well, I wanted to get into that with you because when I was talking to my son yesterday, I don't know if you know this, but my son is 7. He'll be 8 in a couple of weeks. That age group is obsessed with Michael Jordan. Alyssa can say this too because our kids are in the same class. But they're obsessed with him. And so I was talking to him yesterday. He said, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, I'm interviewing Joe Klein. He played with Michael Jordan. Eyes get real big. And I said, well, he also played with Larry Bird, and he played with Charles Barkley. And so the question for you is, who was the best player you ever played with?
Oh, I also had Kobe for a little bit, too.
Can't forget that.
Yeah, but he was a rookie then, so he wasn't what he became. No, I mean, to me, I'm friends with Larry, but I'm not gonna let my friendship with him, even if he was here, say that he, you know, Michael's the best player. Because Michael, first of all, Michael never missed a game. The last 3 years of his career, he missed one game, and it was an exhibition game. So when you're talking about missing, they're talking about exhibition games too. And going to the finals every year. So that 120 games a year, and he didn't miss a game. He missed one game in his last 3 years. He was a great defender. So he would get 30, guard your guy who averaged 25, and that guy would get 13. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, you know, 40 some odd points a game. Mm-hmm. And if he was playing today with the way they call every little, you know, he'd have shot 15 to 20 free throws a game. He'd have averaged 45 a game in this day and age. Because, I mean, you know, if you ever watch it, I mean, back when we played, I mean, it was a third degree assault sometimes in the lane. I mean, it was – they don't have a number for the types of – they got flagrant one and flagrant two. We were doing about flagrant fives. I mean, the worst thing you could do is go in the lane and pump fake a dude, and he'd jump up in the air, and you're going to go up for the shot because he was going to kill you. Mm. He was going to absolutely kill you because you were instructed. You know, I remember Coach, it was like, you do not give up a layup. Like, there was a rule, no layups. So, you know, you stand there and a guy goes in for a layup and you watch him lay it up. Oh my gosh. I mean, your guard just got his head knocked off, and you let their guard go in there and finger roll it in, and you stand there and watch him. Man, you didn't want that smoke.
You like, there's that documentary, The Jordan Rules, where the Pistons, how they guarded, and Laimbeer was such an irritant. And who was the player who got under your skin most?
He's right up there.
Is he?
Yeah. He was we have young adults here, so I'll just leave it at that. He was an irritant, a really diplomatic way of saying it. But he just, you know, there were hard fouls, but he pushed dirty. Hmm. He pushed, you know, taking you out, trying to, he would, if he could somehow find a way to, you know, have you severely sprain your ankle, he would, you know, put his foot under you when you shoot and all that kind of stuff. So I didn't have a lot of use for him.
You're talking about Larry Bird. Bob Holt, who you knew very well, yes, a friend of mine, one of his favorite stories was Bob was based in Dallas for a while, and he would go to Arlington Stadium or Union Arena. He covered the Cowboys when Jerry Jones first bought the team, and he would write stories, you know, that's before the internet. And so he would write stories about players when they would come through Dallas, and then he would send them back here. And so, you know, people here could read about players in their pro career. And he said he went to Reunion Arena one time to interview you when you were playing for the Celtics. And he said that he's sitting there interviewing you, and Larry Bird walks in like, what's going on here? And he said Joe looks at Larry, hey Larry, he's here to interview me, not you.
Yeah. I'm sure Larry probably stood over him and goes, we had to – looked at Bob and said, don't you have anything better to do? Then I'll tell you a great Larry Bird story. I was with him a couple summers ago, and we were sitting around talking, and I was like, you know, we were kind of getting on each other. And I was like, you know what made me so mad about you is, like, I would set a down pick on you, and they would switch it, and I'd have a 6'4 guy on me playing behind me in the post. I'm on the block, got him sealed, and you would never throw me the ball. I said, you would look at me, and you would he would always point down to the floor. That meant, come here, boy, and set me a pick and roll. That's the nice way of putting it. And I was like, you know, that was, and he goes, yeah, I did that a lot. He goes, and then he looked at me, he goes, Joe, if you were me, would you throw you the ball? And I kind of looked at him and I was like, all right, let's go on, let's move on.
Tell me about winning the gold medal in 1984. That's a team that I feel like gets – people of a certain age will remember it, but then you've got the Dream Team and how things changed after that with pro players playing in the NBA. That was a different era, but that was a really cool moment for you all.
Yeah, I mean, the trials were – I mean, there was 100 – they invited, I think, 100 and – over 100 players to Bloomington, Indiana for a week. And we practiced in this it was like a track, indoor track metal building that had a tartan surf, and I think they had 5 courts on there, and Knight had the Bear Bryant Tower in the middle, and, you know, every coach in America was there, and we would kind of go through some, you know, he ran the motion offense, so they would try to teach a little bit of how to run basic motion, and then we would scrimmage, and we would try to, you know, and they would watch us, and they started making cuts, and, you know, went down to 64, and, you know, you would walk into a room, they say, hey, cuts are tomorrow, you'd walk in there, and you'd have a list, and if you didn't have a swipe through your name, you're like, all right, you know, cool, uh-huh. I'm here for another week, you know, and 32, 20, I think 16, and then it went to 14. We had 2 alternates on the team, Johnny Dawkins and I don't know, I can't remember, but it was just the practices were insane. I mean, they just – every day in practice I was watching Alvin Robertson guard Michael Jordan and watching them two go at it every day and having to guard Patrick Ewing, Sam Perkins, Wayman Tisdale. I mean, just, you know, Vern Fleming, just Michael Jordan, Sam Perkins. I mean, it was just every – when we would scrimmage, it would just – it was incredible. Those games were incredible. And then we just started flying around and playing and, played in the Hoosier Dome in front of 65,000 people, played in the Metrodome back in the day in Minneapolis in front of about 60,000 people. You know, when you're 22 years, 21 years old, but now you look back on it and you go, damn, you know, that was pretty cool. And then walking into the Coliseum, and I remember we had to wait all day. We were over at the old Clippers Arena, the sports arena, waiting. Every country would get called, and then you would go and you'd walk over. And we, of course, were the last one. But, you know, I was sitting in there with Mary Lou Retton, we're sitting there talking, and Edwin Moses, Dwight Stone, all these great track and field guys, Carl Lewis, just, you know, walking by, talking, just, and you sit back there and you look on it now, but then walking in and the Coliseum was full and everybody going crazy, and I'll never forget this, talk about being thankful. My dad had leukemia. When I was going through college, and he was able to go to that, and I remember, and you know, back then you didn't have phones or anything, so you just, I remember walking in there and going, man, we got to our spot, and I was standing there, I was like, man, I wish I could see my mom and dad, and I remember looking up, and they were right there, and I walked across the track and was able to give them a hug and everything, and I was like, you know, even at 22, I was like, you know, I didn't have a clue, but I was like, that's a God thing. That was a good day.
You came home, you coached for a little while, you got into you're in the restaurant business now, but you also do a lot of the announcing too. And I think a lot of people may forget that you were on the Razorback Sports Network for a couple of years with Mike Nail.
Yeah, I remember,
wasn't there like one or two times where your feet were so big you turned off the power Mike underneath the table?
Yeah. They had all these plugs under there. And, I got to where I would, like, back away. I would do the game like this so my feet wouldn't go up under the table. But, yeah, I took us off the air a couple times. It was great.
What do you like about broadcasting?
Oh, you get to stay in it. You get to talk to coaches. You get to go to practice. You get to walk, you know, you get to be a small little tiny piece of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you've been doing it forever, you really appreciate that.
You would have played for Calipari when he was what, like mid to late 30s?
How's he changed? Brad knows when he was young, he ain't what he is now. I can tell you that. And he was high strung. I'll say that. He was an Italian, high strung. He was coming into the NBA. He was going to conquer the world. He was a good coach. They didn't give him the time, which, you know, and he was, I remember, we were chartering back, and I mean, the losses would drive him crazy. And I remember he was sitting up at the plane, and he was watching film, and, you know, I'd been in the league 13 years. And so I walked up there and I gave him a beer and I go, "Hey, Cal, it's taken the Nets a long time to perfect how miserable a team can be." And I said, "You've been here 6 months. It's going to take a little while." And you know what? The Nets are still bad today. They're still bad. So it was kind of like, you know, but he wanted to turn it like that. And it doesn't work that way in the NBA.
The NBA is so interesting to me because of the dynamic. You and Calipari probably are within, a couple of years of each other
he's
in
2 years
age?
Older than me.
So it's so much different than when you're playing for Eddie Sutton, who's so much older than you in college or whoever your college coach is. Talk about that dynamic of it's more man-to-man, I feel like, in the NBA.
Yeah, and the players got a lot more power. Yeah. You know, they're you know, as great as Phil Jackson was, everybody knew who ran the Bulls. I mean, and Michael didn't ever do that, but if it came down between Michael or Scotty and Phil Jackson, who was going to leave? Well, we know the hierarchy of that. We know how that, you know, we know who was going to be first, second, and last. I mean, it damn sure wasn't going to be Michael. Yeah. But again, to his credit and the great players like Bird and Charles and a lot of them, they don't use that power. You know, they don't use that power. So, but what's scary is it's kind of getting the way sports is going, because, you know, it's a business. Mm-hmm. You have a salary cap. You have to make decisions based on salary. You know, what do we need? What we got? And you have limited this draft picks and all this, and you run it like a business. You're trying to make money and run it like a business, which is what is turning into the college level. But again, the problem with what's going on now in college is there's not an owner. Mm-hmm. That's the deal. Like the old saying, the buck stops here. Where does the buck stop in college athletics? Yeah. Nobody knows.
Yeah. I got two more for you about this year's team. They play Kentucky this weekend, big game. Obviously, I don't know if you've seen the ticket prices, but they're incredible for this game.
Really? How much?
They're a lot.
I got six. Let's see.
You could maybe pay Charles Robinson's tab with your
if
six tickets.
I got two grandkids that would – there ain't enough money. So I would be in bad shape if I did that.
This matchup, what's the key for Arkansas, do you feel like, to beat Kentucky?
Kentucky has changed. I mean, they came into the year, they got a you want to talk money? They got a $22 million payroll. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let that soak in for a minute. And so they started off the year, they were shooting about 33s a game, and they were really trying to get up and down. They had difficulty with that. They had some injuries. They had some guard issues. They've even had, I think they lost their point guard and another guy. And so they have really changed how they play. They've almost become kind of a grind it team, if there's such a thing anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, they're a little bigger. They try to play a little more physical. They shoot about 20 threes a game. They're not going to walk the ball up the floor, but if they don't have an advantage, they're going to run a set. Mm-hmm. They're good though. Until Vanderbilt the other night, where they got thumped again on the road, they had won five in a row before that. So they had kind of figured some things out and were feeling good about themselves. But, you know, I mean, we got thumped at Auburn and got thumped at Georgia. So that's life in the SEC. You got to deal with that. But I suspect it's going to be they'll be jacked up because, you know, we got Calipari on our side and he's having some success. And, you know, everybody over there in Kentucky is very resentful and not happy that he's having that success. Uh-huh. Because they wouldn't have a problem with it. The only problem is that Cal left before they got to fire him, uh-huh. and that pisses him off.
By the way, you guys can understand that Calipari's winning the breakup right now. One last one for you. I heard Dane Bradshaw say something on the broadcast last night, or a couple of nights ago. He said, you can't have a Final Four offense and a round of 32 defense. It feels like the defense is going to be – how much the defense improves is going to be a key to how far Arkansas can go. What do you think they need to do to patch that up?
Well, I mean, they got a rebound. Oklahoma – you saw the problem with penetration. You know, penetration kills defenses because, again, it gets you scrambling and gets you chasing and – against good teams, they're going to find the open guy, and when you get to the NCAA tournament, you're going to play all good teams. Mm-hmm. So they're going to if you're constantly getting broken down here, they're going to exploit that. They're going to make you pay for that. So again, they are a great offensive team. They don't have to be a great defensive team. But Brad, we need 20 minutes of hell. We don't need 40. We need 20. We'll take 20. But again, in basketball, you know, and I think a little bit old school, I always feel that at some point in every game, you got to be able to stop somebody three or four times in a row to either put your foot on their neck and finish them, mm-hmm. or get back in the game. Mm-hmm. You know, and like if you're a decent defensive team and you play Georgia the other week, you're not down 19-3. Mm-hmm. You're down 15-7, 15-8. But you can't have these 19-3s, 25-2, because, man, those are hard to come back from. Mm-hmm. You know, they were right there the other night down 13, and it was teetering on here we go again. Mm-hmm. But to their credit, they finished the half.
Joe, we appreciate you coming up here.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.